Greater Minnesota Economic and Workforce Development Policy Committee to order. And I anticipate somebody has read the minutes. Willing to move?
I'm moving.
Bill, that you want to move? Okay, Mr. Somerhoy is moving the minutes.
Third. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Nay. Motion carries. Now we're up to, yes.
Mr. Chair, I just have a procedural question for you. I was looking with the staff as we were preparing for today's meeting, and many of the amendments, or at least a number of them, were posted after the deadline, and so I'm wondering how are we to know the time on the amendment is like 4:30, but it didn't get posted till quite a bit later, so as we were looking for what amendments were at 5 o'clock, they weren't in. So I'm wondering, is the rule that they get written or they get posted?
See ya.
No, just I'm just wondering.
Representative,
yeah.
The committee administrator was in a meeting until too late and didn't get them posted in time.
Okay, so no. Generally, they'll be there. Well, I just wondered if we were going to have them filed by 5 or they just need to be written by 5. That was my question.
And if you do have a problem, you can always call me. Phone a friend.
Phone a friend. And Mr. Chair, we don't really have a timeline for secondary amendments or any of that in committee, so.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question. And with that, we are going to go first. First bill would be House File 614, Representative Baker. See you in the... Baker's not here.
Next.
Okay, next bill. Pardon me? He's on his way. We have two witnesses here.
Start with the
Why don't we start with the witnesses, and you can come up to the table and give your names. And here he is. Ta-da. Just go right up to the testifying table, sir. I will move House File 614 to pass and go to Health and Human Services.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, I was in the wrong room. I didn't look at my calendar quite well enough, so my apologies to you and the committee for being a couple minutes late. My name is Dave Baker. I'm here to probably discuss House File 614, and I guess I'd like to talk about a couple of the amendments that are in front of you, the committee today, that I'd like to address.
Okay.
I actually have two amendments to the bill to get it in the proper order.
A5 and A7. Which one you take first?
Let's take the A5-2 amendment first.
Okay. Would you please I will move the A5-2 amendment. Would you please describe your amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will have my testifier, Carrie, take care of this for me and then explain in detail what this is.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr.
Please
Chair.
Give your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm the Senior Vice President of Advocacy for Leading Age Minnesota here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the A5-2 amendment adds a couple of additional features to the bill that, quite frankly, were always intended to be part of the bill and just needed to be added. So the first part of the bill, and we'll go through this also once the bill is kind of in its final form, adds and creates a scholarship program for employees working in home and community-based service settings. These are like assisted living or adult day settings to help pay for schooling to further careers of employees working in those settings and to help cover. It's sort of modeled after a nursing facility scholarship program that's already in existing law. On page 2 of the amendment, so much of the first section of the amendment deals with that. On page 2 of the amendment, starting on line 25, there puts in, excuse me, yes, that's correct. There creates an ability to create career ladder adjustments, wage enhancements for individuals working in senior care settings to enhance their wages if they participate in career ladder programs, such as apprenticeship programs or leadership training programs, and provides some wage enhancements for that. On page 3 of the amendment, there is an appropriation for targeted workforce center funding to help address some of the recruitment issues that we have and help recruit and train and promote vacant positions in caregiving careers. And then the second to last section is the appropriation for the Home and Community-Based Services Scholarship Program. And the last section is the appropriation related to the career ladder rate adjustment that we just talked about.
Representative Norton, excuse me.
Thank you, and I feel like I'm being really grumbly here already today. Sorry.
I know you aren't.
I know. It's just one of those days. Ms.
Don't
Thurlow.
Near my level, yeah.
I'll work on it. I'm supportive of what you're doing. I'm a little concerned that this is being amended on in this committee rather than the Long-Term Care Committee, who specializes in this stuff, having served on HHS. I know this is really kind of in the weeds for a committee like this one necessarily. But so my first question was, is this going to go back to the Long-Term Care, or do they know what you're doing? Because you're changing policy they've looked at and approved.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, the bill will go to Health and Human Services Reform. That also has jurisdiction over this. We did discuss, and again, the intent was that this was supposed to be in it originally. So I think we had a general conversation about it, but the language just wasn't ready for the aging committee as these things happen. So I don't know that the intent is necessarily to go back to aging committee, but it will go to Health and Human Services Reform.
And then the second piece, thank you, Mr. Chair, has to do with what you're talking about, the workforce centers, and I assume, one of the pipeline jobs and apprenticeships is in this area. Is this linking to that particular one, or is this something different, or could you...
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, thanks for that question. Yeah, so the career ladder wage enhancement does somewhat link to that pipeline program. If you look at the pipeline report, it does specifically talk about a specific health support specialist apprenticeship that's designed specifically for long-term care. That money could be used for this for people who go through that program. It's a little bit broader than that because it would also cover kind of homegrown leadership programs as well. So it's a little bit broader definition than some of those pipeline programs, but definitely that fits.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to ask some questions about the apprenticeship program that you're talking about in here. So the apprenticeship program that you're talking about in here, does that have a contract with the employer?
So Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, thank you for that question. It could. The language is written.
No, the question is it does. It does have to. So that's a yes or no.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, the language in the amendment refers to apprenticeship programs, but it also refers to other types of leadership programs. The apprenticeship program that we were just previously discussing, the health support specialist program, which is a specific example, is a federally recognized apprenticeship program that has all of the requirements of any other apprenticeship program. So yes, that particular program does have those contractual requirements. But the language in the amendment is broader than just apprenticeship programs.
Mr. Chair.
Mahoney.
And you're saying that the funding in this, and there's no, I don't know that there's a dollar figure in this particular bill at the present time, but all apprenticeship programs that are run in this state that I know of, and I know of a good number of them, are self-funded. So why should the state pay for yours? I mean, there's hundreds of millions of dollars, well over $100 million in apprenticeship costs to employers in this state, union and non-union. They pay for all of them. Why would we want to pay for yours?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, thank you for that question. I think there's a couple of reasons. for one, the state controls the vast majority of the rates that we're able to pay or charge to consumers of senior care services. And as a result, the wages then are also somewhat controlled to the rates here. So that would be one reason. The second is these are very low-paying jobs right now. Many of the individuals that start off in senior care careers that want to build a ladder start out at about $10 an hour and oftentimes don't have the resources to self-fund to do those career ladders. Quite honestly, it is easier for them to leave senior care and go into other professions. And so I think given the age wave and the growing demand for senior care services, the bill in its entirety and that particular section in of itself is designed to really try to build career ladders that make it attractive for people to stay and work in senior care settings for a long period of time.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
The one piece of your answer there is you implied that it was the apprentice that was paying the cost. Most apprenticeship programs are paid by the industry, and a small percentage of it is paid by the apprentice. So again, why should the state create welfare for corporations? Because rather than imply that it's the low-wage worker, because the low-wage worker is not supposed to be paying for an apprenticeship. It is the employer that is supposed to be paying for an apprenticeship.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I think the primary reason that we would say that it's appropriate in this situation is because the state largely controls our ability to our revenues or providers' revenues. 80 to 90% of the revenues that providers are able to generate are tied directly to the rates set by lawmakers. Right now, those rates are woefully underfunded, and providers don't have the extra money to pay for or self-fund those apprenticeship programs themselves. And so we think that kind of given the structure that we're in today, that it seems appropriate that we would bring this forward.
Any other questions on the A52 amendment? That's it. With that, I will move the A52 amendment to be included in the bill. Now the A7 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to introduce the A7 amendment as well for really just cleaning up our language on the original bill. This came from some very good discussions with the department, and I think we've got some folks here today that could speak to this if they choose. But again, it just was after having them clarify some things when they, if they executed this thing, if this bill were to pass, they wanted to make sure there was some language clarity, and this really just makes our initial bill more clear for the department. So we would introduce A7, but I also want to ask that I have an oral amendment to this A7, and I don't know if I want to take that one first, and it's a very small change, and I'll read it for you, but when do I introduce Mr. Chair?
We can incorporate your oral amendment, but before we do that, I'm told that we have to have a vote on the A5 amendment. All in favor of the A5 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Nay. A5 amendment is approved. We can incorporate your oral amendment as long as it's not too long.
Right. Very short. And if I could address my oral amendment. On the back page of the A7 amendment that's in front of you on line 2.11, we wanted to clarify what reasonable child care costs sort of meant. So after direct educational expenses, comma, and reasonable costs as defined by the commissioner for child care costs and transportation expenses related to direct educational expenses. So I'm adding the words after the word and, reasonable cost as defined by the commissioner for, and then we going back up to child care costs. We felt it was just too unknown. I think we wanted to make sure the commissioner had reasonable costs associated with this so that we weren't using daycare facilities that were maybe family members before or something. So we wanted to make sure that that was part of this amendment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
I'm going to guess that somewhere in here, which commissioner are you talking about? Because I didn't have time to read the amendment.
The DHS commissioner.
Okay.
Thank you.
And that's somewhere in the bill here? Okay.
Does everybody understand the amendment? All in favor of the oral amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Nay. Continue, please.
Okay. There we go. Do we have all the amendments in now? Also 7 as well?
Yes.
Okay.
We have to vote on 7.
Okay.
You got any questions on the A7 amendment, members? Seeing none, I will move the A7 amendment be adopted. Please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Nay. Motion carries. Now the bill should be in the shape that you want it to be in.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And to get to our bill now of House File 614, our overall goal in this bill is to really just help address the shortage of professional caregivers and to the help providers of senior care services are needed to recruit and retain caregiving in the workforce. One of the key issues that I've heard about since being elected is the severe shortages of the caregivers around the state, and again, especially in rural Minnesota. In nursing homes alone, there's an estimated 1,800 open, unfilled caregiving positions. Unfortunately, this is happening at a time when our senior population and demand for services will grow year after year. In greater Minnesota, that means that in some cases, nursing homes need to turn away seniors that they need care because they just don't have the staff to provide that selective care. This is a real critical workforce need, and I firmly believe we need to help build a pipeline to get these people into careers in senior care services so we can address this shortage now and for the future. House File 614 is a set of strategies that has been identified by providers that will help address the issues they face in recruitment, training, and retention. In addition to the strategies that we all just discussed in the A5 amendment, the bill would also provide the expanded loan forgiveness program to both nursing programs, which are RNs and LPNs, and reduces the service obligations for nurses. It expands the existing nursing facility scholarship program to allow for that loan forgiveness for newly hired nurses. The bill also proposes to expand the scholarship program to cover additional expenses, including that child care component I had mentioned earlier. It will allow a rate increase for nursing homes to recover expenses related to training nursing assistants. It will establish a long-term care grant program through the Department of DEED to advance long-term care careers. The bill would also fund a study through DEED to explore additional tax credits and the hiring incentives that may help providers. With me today, folks, again, are just some folks from the Long-Term Care Imperative to further discuss this important bill.
I will. Please give your name and testify.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Erin Bowie, and I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Care Providers of Minnesota. I'm here today on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. I want to thank Representative Baker for bringing this important bill forward. As Representative Baker mentioned, he didn't mention this part, so I'll just start again. Minnesota is looking at 60,000 new seniors per year through the year 2030. In less than 5 short years, we will, for the first time, have more seniors than school children, and that trend does not change in the foreseeable future. Currently, long-term care facilities are facing a worker shortage. As Representative Baker mentioned, there are over 1,800 vacancies in nursing facilities across the state. Some facilities have the capacity to take more seniors in, but cannot do so because they do not have the staff to care for them. Providers regularly lose entry-level employees to fast food restaurants who offer a competitive or better starting salary for a job that doesn't have the physical or emotional strains that often come with long-term care positions. The long-term care field hires the majority of nursing school graduates, but by the time the 18-month mark rolls around, most have left for jobs in hospital settings that can pay tens of thousands of dollars more. A couple examples of the amount of turnover facilities are facing. The statewide average turnover for CNA positions sits at 49% a year. For RNs, it's 38%, and LPNs, it's 37% per year. This type of turnover has obvious impacts on the seniors the employees care for, their families, and the facilities that employ them. The workforce challenges facing long-term care cannot be overstated. It is an issue we need to look at fixing now, as it is only going to continue to grow in magnitude as the age wave hits Minnesota. Again, I want to thank Representative Baker for bringing this bill forward. It is a strong first step in helping long-term care facilities to find better ways to recruit, train, and retain employees. And now I'll turn it over to Carrie to talk a little bit more about how the specifics of the bill will help long-term care facilities.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Again, my name is Carrie Thurlow with Leading Age Minnesota. I know I've taken a lot of committee time already walking through the A5, so I'll be brief but happy to answer any questions. I want to join in thanking Representative Baker for bringing this bill forward and really digging into the issue of workforce. Both the organization that Aaron represents as well as my organization are statewide organizations that represent the continuum of senior care providers. While you might first think of nursing homes, you also need to think about assisted living settings and home care agencies and adult day centers and community-based providers. That's really the spectrum that we are looking at. And the number one issue that we hear of from our members when we go out, the number one thing that keeps them awake at night is, how am I going to fill those vacant positions? How am I going to fully staff and cover all of my shifts? And how am I going to keep these people once I get them in the door? Then the second question is, are these the right people for these jobs? Caregiving is not an easy job. It takes a special kind of person to get into these jobs. But the reality is we're going to need more of them. As our population ages, the demand for senior care will grow. That's a fact. I don't think we can deny that. And with 60,000 new seniors coming on board now and for the next 15 years, every year for the next 15 years, we have to get ready for this and build pipelines to get people to the jobs that we know will exist today and in the future. And so this bill, there's a lot of parts to it, but it does represent strategies that have been tested out where providers have been tested them and have been shown to be successful on small scale, and what providers have said that if you give them these tools that they think that it will help address their issues. Scholarship programs help build pipelines because it encourages people to continue to build their careers. They might start off as a CNA in a nursing home, but continue to go on to school and to become a nurse, an LPN or an RN. And the scholarship program helps them do that without accumulating debt, but also continuing to work in those nursing homes. By the way, that's a great benefit for the seniors that are receiving that care. We think that that has the added benefit of enhancing quality in those settings. Bringing that to home and community-based services only makes sense. Loan forgiveness programs, making it easier for nurses to access. The current program isn't quite being used as much as we'd like, so making it a little more flexible for those nurses we think will help us retain those nurses. Supporting dual education programs like apprenticeship programs where it's been piloted, has been very successful, has increased staff satisfaction, and by the way, it's increased resident satisfaction as well. And so, yes, there's a lot of moving parts here, but we think it's moving in the right direction. Yes, there are blank appropriations here, and that's going to be an ongoing conversation for the Finance Committee. But again, really do want to thank Representative Baker and the co-authors for bringing this forward to help us address this growing need. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Representative Moran.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I think this is a great idea to create pipelines to jobs, and, you know, loan forgiveness and scholarships is always a good way to bring more people into the field because long-term care is important. Does this bill in any way, I was just thinking, you know, and those are good programs to get people in the program, but unless there's a sustainable wage, you know, it won't keep them there. You know, so is anything in this bill that does anything about that issue, and which is a really big issue?
Mr. Chair, Representative Moran, thank you for that question. We definitely, I'm sure there's a small bill out there, House File 316, that deals with the funding side and the wages and benefits for caregivers as well. We know, of course, wages and benefits is a huge issue for us, tied very much to the reimbursement system for senior care. And so there is a separate bill moving on that. That, of course, is an important issue. But we know that wages and benefits isn't the only part of the piece, so we wanted to bring this set of proposals forward as well.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, in addition to the wages, and of course there's another bill moving through, and I don't know how we're going to prioritize, you know, where the money gets spent, but if we have enough of it to spread around, I think the scholarships and loan forgiveness are certainly good. We had a bill earlier that was also doing a similar had a similar idea and was adding a bunch of other providers to that loan forgiveness program, and at the time I raised the issue that the more people we keep adding, the less we'll get out of it unless we increase the amount. That was one of the concerns I had with, I think, Representative Keel's bill when she came through. And so on this one, you're working on nurses and primarily the LPNs and the RNs, which I think is great and much needed. I just spent some time at Samaritan Bethany last Friday. And know of the need there. I'm a little nervous that we're not getting enough. We're not providing enough to this resource to get enough people. I mean, you know, if we're talking 6 new people across the whole state of Minnesota, that's just, you know, it's just a drop in the bucket for the need. We had, I think they said 100. I'm going to get it wrong. 123 or 132 openings currently at Samaritan Bethany alone. I mean, it's huge. We had the young lady I spoke to had just put in 65 hours a week for 2 weeks in a row because they don't have employees and she's taking second shifts. I mean, we just can't have, we're going to wear them out, and these were people very excited about their new jobs. So I appreciate what you're trying to do. I think we need to get employees in those buildings so we don't have people working double shifts, and we need more funding. To the nursing issue, which is the question I have, you have serving a minimum of 2 years of full-time service to qualify. I'm a little frustrated with that because one of the things I heard there, in addition to the CNAs, was that nurses turn over all the time and get taken away. But if they're there long enough to get their loans paid off and you can stretch it longer than 2 years, you might be able to keep them in that job longer. So I wondered about if you had some thought about why 2 years, and is that an incentive enough to make it 3, say, or 4?
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, thank you for that question. Yes, you'll note that this is a policy change. The current nurse loan forgiveness requires 3 years in long-term care settings. And I don't have the data in front of me about how much that program is being used at the 3-year mark, but it's not very many nurses are taking advantage of that. As Aaron shared with you, we hire the vast majority of new nurses. Most hospitals require a year of service. And so usually we hire over 70% of the new nurses, but within 18 months they're gone.
Right.
And that 3-year calculation or that 3-year requirement seems to be a little bit too much. That on average, when they do the math, because an RN can make about $35,000 a year more in a hospital than in a nursing home, it just doesn't make sense to hang out for 3 years financially.
And I completely agree, which is why we get back to Representative Moran's issue, which is the pay, and that's the problem. If we can raise the rate and pay them and keep them there longer, that would be more ideal than lowering the time to 2 years and not dealing with the pay issues. So just, I know you struggle with this. I know Samaritan Bethany and everybody in my area struggles with this, but we've got to do something to keep people working in those, you know, those very important jobs. So keep looking at that one.
Representative Norton, unfortunately, we decide what the pay is.
I know.
And
we never decide enough.
I agree with that. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development on February 1st put out the Minnesota Cost of Living Study, the annual one. What did you say the average wage is for a nursing home person that you're dealing with in this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I believe that the average starting wage for a CNA, which is what I was referring to, is between $10 and $11 an hour.
So in Economic Development Region 1, the minimum cost of living hourly wages that is needed to cover child care, health care, housing, transportation, food, taxes is $13.08. In the Headwaters, it's $14.19. In the Arrowhead, it's $13.96. I can go on. None of them, you don't get to that. Any of these regions are all above $10, $11. So Representative Norton had a good point. I just wanted to kind of point that out. I'm going to use this on later bills, so I'll keep that copy. Members, you can get that copy of this by calling Deed or going to their website, and it really does list it out, gives you an idea of what the cost is. And one of the, Mr. Chair and Representative Baker, I did do some digging, and right now approximately 24 people are using this loan forgiveness in the fashion that you're asking it to. But my understanding from Deed is that there's 1,800 current vacancies. Now, if you do the math at 1,800, if you divide the 24 into the 260,000 that's typically given, that's in this program not right now, it's about $11,000 a year. In order to fully fund this particular program, it's $20 million a year. So I guess you could fill in that fiscal dollar figure pretty quickly at $20 million, and I'm not sure where the target is for the fiscal department. I don't want to get too deep into this, but right now, members, I think I totaled up the numbers that have come through this committee, and we're well over $300 million. So Representative Garofalo, good luck to you. I think this is a good idea. I mean, I'm going to get old someday too, you know, even though I'm going to deny it.
Someday.
You haven't seen me angry yet. this is a big dollar figure. And how do you get more people than 24 to buy into this? I don't know that how you're going to do that. But it is a dollar figure that I wish was in the bill, so because that does tie into the policy. And without the dollar figure, it's hard to know if this is a policy we should really delve into or just let slide. My real question here is, because the I feel like I should have Rick Hansen on my nameplate right now. Seeing how we've done so much on Greater Minnesota, and everything is focused on Minnesota, Greater Minnesota, bills seem to be coming out of particular agencies that just focus on Greater Minnesota. Does this bill help anybody in the 11 county metro area?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, so I'll take your last question first and then maybe just briefly on the other question. This is a statewide bill. Our caregiver workforce shortage is statewide.
So far.
Our caregiving workforce shortage is statewide, so we can use all the help we can get. As to the question of the 1,800 vacancies, you're right. It's 1,800 vacancies in nursing homes. The vast majority of those are actually CNAs and not nurses that would take advantage of the loan forgiveness program. The loan forgiveness program, and I might have to defer to my friends at the Department of Health, has a cap on how much each recipient can receive as well on that. So we are working hard to, and that program is scalable. They don't pay out more than what is appropriated there. But again, you're right, that 1,800 number is big. We got to get to work on it, but it's not all nurses. It's a lot of CNAs and other direct care workers as well.
Thank you. Representative Mahoney, there's going to be a bill coming in the future for long-term care called 316. It puts nursing home on a cost basis the way it was several years ago. I'm sure you're going to vote for it. And with that, we have any questions? Other questions? Seeing none, I will then renew my motion to have House File 614 as amended pass and be sent to Human Services. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Passed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And first we're going to get Ryan Baumtrack to come from MHFA to come tell us about our next bill, which is House, no, okay, we'll just overview, okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Baumtrag, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Policy and Community Development at Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. And I'm actually here at the request of House staff to just provide an overview and some research that we did to estimate the need for workforce housing for renters in Minnesota. So not speaking to a specific bill, but just an overview. Before I get into the estimate, just wanted to let people know that it is an estimate intended just to give the statewide need for rental housing. So at the House's request, we looked into this issue and did some work with our research staff at Minnesota Housing. And Minnesota Housing has identified 77 workforce housing communities in Minnesota. And I believe right now is being handed out a map that'll show you where those 77 communities are statewide. And these are communities that had at least 2,000 jobs in 2013 and significant job growth between 2008 and 2013. And we significant job growth in greater Minnesota meant 100 jobs were added between 2008 and 2013. The other way a community would be determined as a workforce community was if they had long commute. And we define that by having more than 15% of the workers traveling 30 plus miles for the job. So that's the criteria that we use to identify these statewide 77 workforce housing communities. And this is the same criteria that Minnesota Housing used to identify these communities with the Housing and Job Growth Initiative over the past 2 years, where we allocated $10 million to projects within the state to address workforce housing needs. So what we found was that in these communities, to address the statewide shortage of rental housing in these 77 communities, we'd need approximately 4,500 to 7,500 additional rental units statewide. To do that, if we did that, would bring the average vacancy rate in these communities from 2.5% on average up to 4% at the 4,500 level, or up to 5% vacancy rate at the 7,500 level. And once you get to 4 to 5% vacancy range, that's when it's fairly well considered to be a balanced market. So that was what we determined was the statewide need. So just wanted to stop with that to see if there are any questions about the statewide need. Otherwise, we also looked into some of the characteristics of those workforce communities as well.
Any questions?
So with that, maybe I'll just give some quick remarks on the characteristics in the workforce communities. We looked at, with Department of Deed data, the wages for the new jobs added in 2013, as well as the household income for both renters and homeowners in those same 77 workforce communities. And what we found is that in most communities, that over 90% of the typical new hires in those communities had wages below $58,000. We also looked at typical renter and homeowner household income in these same communities that we just handed out, and we found that the typical renter household income was approximately $30,000, and the typical homeowner household income was approximately $70,000. So that was the research that we did on behalf of the House staff, just to provide a quick overview of the rental housing units statewide, and then also the income ranges in those same communities.
Thank you. Just out of curiosity, what is the average metro family wage or metro wage, and what is the average greater Minnesota wage?
Mr. Chair, I don't know that I have that information on me. I'm going to look to see if we have that on us. We don't have that on us. We can get back to you with that one.
Mr. Chair, according to Deed's cost of living, the cost of living and hourly wages, in the median wage for Twin Cities Metro Regional 11 is $18.15. Southeast, it is the same. Southwest, it is the same. Well, that's a statewide average. And then you get into the urban Twin City Metro, it's $19.92. and southeast it's 17, southwest it's 14 and 26.
That's where I live.
Yeah. Well, and we can go more. We can go the north central is $14. West central is $15.39.
So there is a significant difference, but not as significant as I thought. And I want to clear the air one thing. You know, when Representative Mahoney was chairman of this wing, he treated Greater Minnesota very kindly last biennium, and he's not nearly as grumpy as he acts.
But I can get worse. Just ask Norton.
Okay. Representative Dill.
Well, it's a very interesting map. I look at the 15,800 square miles that I represent. I don't see that we're even a Greater Minnesota Workforce Housing Community as an entire legislative district, which is larger than nine different states in the United States. And we don't have any housing needs, but every single community, including the ones sitting in this audience today, are clamoring for housing. And I look at, and I understand you put parameters in there, I get that, but I mean 2,000 jobs, there's only 5,000 people live in Cook County, there's only 11,000 people live in Lake County, and most of those drive 100 miles a day, average driving, to get to and from their job. If they drive in from the end of the Gunflint, it's 56 miles each way. My wife drives 108 miles round trip to go teach sixth grade. But yet every community is just absolutely clamoring for housing. So with this map, I understand what it says. But when I look at northern Minnesota and you draw a line across Highway 2, maybe that's not quite perfect. But I really only see that there's any, according to this, there's any need in greater Minnesota except where Roseau and where Thief or where Polaris and Articat and Digikey are located. Otherwise, the northern part of the state, everybody must have houses and everybody must be happy and everybody must be making enough money.
I have a feeling that's why we all like to go there.
So anyway, I just make that as an observation. I also notice it in the southwest part of the state, except down in the very tip corner. And I'm looking and represent Keel's district and represent Fabian's, represent Hancock's, my own district, represent Purcell's district, except for in the Bemidji area, which is probably driven by the college, a lot of that economic opportunity. We're kind of in a desert here. Just an observation. I won't take any more time. Thank you.
Well taken. Representative Mahoney, you have another question?
Mr. Chair, I don't know if they did any of searched any of this, but you talk somewhere between 4,500 and 7,500. And again, this is a policy committee, so I don't want to get too deep into it. What is your typical subsidy to a housing unit? I mean, do you typically kick in 10%, 20%, 25%? And what's the typical cost of a unit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, in Greater Minnesota, the average cost of new construction per unit ranges from about $185,000 to $205,000 for new construction. When we're talking about workforce housing and the work of the agency, one of the tools that we use most often since 1999 is the Challenge Fund. And in fiscal year 14, the average grant from, or the average financing from the Challenge Fund for each unit was just over $16,000.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Minnesota Housing Finance? Seeing none. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
You enlightened us very well. Next, we have what? Next, we have House File 422. Representative Fabian. Now, I see you have an amendment on here, the A3 amendment. Would you like to incorporate that first, or you'd like to have that later?
We can do, Mr. Chair. Thank you. We can do that now.
And we're going to move this. I will move House File 422 to to pass and be referred to Jobs Committee. And I will move the A3 amendment. Is that the way you want it done?
Yes, Mr. Chair, if you please.
Yep. Proceed. Tell us about your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, first of all, everybody, for being here. I wish that I had a magic wand and I could just wave it over this issue that we have in the state of Minnesota and make it better. Quite frankly, what we're proposing here today, and we've had the informational hearing earlier, we've talked about this. I recognize that this is probably a starting point, and we're going to have a lot of discussions as the process moves forward. But to the A3 amendment, basically what's happening on line 1.2, 1.3, 1.5, and 1.6, we're simply changing how many miles there. We're changing the mileage from 25 to 30 miles. And then the 1.4 line, if you look on page 2 of your bill, line 2.24, we're inserting the number of $20,000 per unit or 20%. And that's the A3 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Any questions from the members on the A3 amendment? Seeing none, I move the A3 amendment to pass and be included in this bill. All in favor of that, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Passed. And then we have another amendment. Representative Dill has an amendment, the A3 amendment, A2 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A2 amendment, and I have a, on line 1.12, I have a one-word change. On line 1.12, strike the word agency at the end of the change language and insert authority. And that would make it consistent with the balance of with the remainder of the amendment and also statute that's in law currently for Cook County.
We will incorporate that oral amendment in your amendment.
Thank you very much. Members, this goes back to the comments that I had a few moments ago about the map that we were shown. And the bill is, as Representative Fabian's, a great start. But we have a unique situation, and we have Mr. Boyd here. I see he's on the list to testify. And if we have any specific questions about this amendment that are drilling down into any details, we'll have him come forward. But the purpose of the amendment is Cook County is the only county of the 87 counties that has a statute for its benefit that allows its county and city to have a joint economic development authority. And also, with a 1,500 population, it would exempt, they wouldn't qualify, the city wouldn't qualify for this because they are less than the 1,500. Now, the 500 was put in there arbitrarily. We could take another number higher than that. This, I want to emphasize that Cook County is an outlier here. And so what the purpose of the amendment is, and through all of these inserts and remove and before line this, that, and the other, is to get the County of Cook and the City of Grand Marais jointly as a joint economic development authority under current statute eligible to be included in this bill. I'm not aware of any other county that's in this situation. that's the purpose of the amendment.
Okay, Representative Fabian, do you have any?
Mr. Chair, almost without exception, anything that comes from Mr. Dill, I would view as being, Representative Dill, excuse me, I would view as being a friendly amendment, so I would encourage the committee to support this.
Any questions from the members? Seeing none, I will renew my motion to have A2 amendment passed and be incorporated in the bill. All in favor of that, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
And Mr. Chairman, just in your motion, I want to make sure that it was the A2 amendment as amended.
As amended.
Okay,
very
thank
good
you.
Point. Thank you. All in favor of that, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendment passed. Now the bill is the way it should be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, and I want to be respectful of everybody's time, and I especially want to be respectful of the time of the people that have made an effort to get down here to address this bill and this issue. So I do want to quickly just point out you know, since I was elected in 2011, this is probably one of the biggest issues that I've dealt with at a local level. We've had several housing meetings in Roseville County, in Thief River Falls, and Pennington County, and it just the problem seems to be getting bigger instead of getting solved. And we did have the good fortune in the last session to do a little bit of work on this, but you know, we're a long ways from being there. I don't know what the final solution is going to be, Mr. Chair. I know that Chair Garofalo is going to have some ideas, and seriously, folks, I'm looking for some solutions to these problems. And I know there's not a limitless pot of money out there to be able to do all this stuff, but what I'm looking for is some really good ideas that we can incorporate into legislation to start chipping away at this. I would like to point out, Mr. Chair, in your packets there was an article, you know, from the Wall Street Journal last Friday, and it specifically talks about the housing situation, workforce housing situation in Northwest Minnesota. It makes a specific reference to Thief River Falls and Roseville, Pennington County and Roseville County. Now, my district is only a third of the size in square miles as Representative Dills. I think it's still larger than two states. I'm not exactly sure, but it is a. I encourage you to take some time to read about this. And Mr. Chair, I would like to introduce Todd Peterson. He's our city administrator. He can introduce himself for the record and so forth. But I really would like to have him kind of walk through what's happened in Roseville and how a bill like this could be helpful to other people.
Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Todd Peterson. I'm the Community Development Coordinator for the City of Roseville, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of this bill and a couple other bills for workforce housing. Workforce housing is a really serious issue for our community, and it has been for a long time. I started the city 19 years ago, and in 19 years ago, housing was difficult to find then. However, there was a difference 19 years ago. 19 years ago, there were builders building. We had a building boom in Roseville at that time. We're not seeing that anymore. And so something's obviously changed between then and now. And so we've tried to assess what those changes are that have created this lack of, I guess, market for development. And what we've kind of arrived at is there's just a multitude of forces that have come together and really taken the profitability out of housing, and so there's really no appetite for it. One of the primary problems is high cost of building materials. Those have gone up dramatically over the last 20 years. The other is just the lack of labor, both to work at Polaris as well as to build houses and housing, so that drives those wages up and makes that more expensive. And then changes in the building code, changes in energy efficiency standards, all of those things have made it more difficult to be profitable in small communities like Roseville. The rents are low. We had a market study done, and the average rent in Roseville County is $555 a month. If you wanted to build a new apartment to be profitable, you would need to charge about $1,300 a month. So obviously there's a huge gap between where historic rents have been and where new construction's at now, and that's the thing we're trying to bridge. And we're looking for tools to be able to do that, and we hope some of this legislation will help us with that. We were fortunate that last year there was a pilot program put together through DEED to provide us with a grant ability to be able to provide to a private developer to incentivize them to want to try and build. And we had a local developer who was willing to step in the water and see how they could make it work. And the first issue that we saw was when they developed the project was going to cost $3.3 million to construct. And when they went to go see what they could charge for reasonable rents, which were actually quite a bit higher than existing rents, they were looking at $850 a month as being their target rent. But in order to make that rent, they needed to drive down the cost, and so that's where the grant program came in. The city came in with quite a bit of money to try and drive that cost down. So per unit, the apartments were going to cost $110,000 per unit, but to be profitable at $850 a month, they needed to be driven down to actually $80,000 a unit. So the city and state provided subsidy to help do that. However, we came up with another problem, that because we're a small community and rents are low, the appraisal came in much lower than was needed. And so the apartments ended up only appraising at $71,000 a unit. So we have all kinds of problems that get in the way of making these things profitable. And in order to make this one project work, which I don't think the city or the developer or anybody would probably do again in order to make a profit, we did get secured a bank loan for about half of the project cost. The developer had to mortgage a separate building that he owned, a different business, for about $520,000 to bring into the project. That still wasn't enough equity, so the city had to come in with a second mortgage on the existing apartment for another $162,500, on top of what the city provided in a $400,000 deferred loan to match the $325,000 state grant. And then the Roseau EDA came in and provided the land free of charge at $60,000 in value. So that was how we had to cobble something together, and still in that, you know, we're not sure it's going to work because of the high rents. You know, will it fill quick enough? Because there's such a tight profit margin there that if they don't fill up right away, they could end up going under. Also, during construction, there were issues that the prevailing wage clause that came with the state money drove up costs from where they were originally projected to be. So the state money was less effective than it could have been initially. And so those were just some of the issues we had in putting this project together. Still such a large gap. Although the city needed to do something, we were desperate for housing. I'm not sure the city could do another project like this. And without the city coming in with that, I don't think there'd be any project at all. So what we're looking for are some additional tools that we can help provide to developers to get beyond some of the issues that are challenges to getting housing in our community. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Todd. I'd also like to introduce J.R. Burke and have him address this issue from a slightly different perspective.
Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is J.R. Burke. I am the manager of state and provincial government relations for Polaris Industries. As most of you know, Polaris Industries is founded in 1954 up in Roseau, so it's been around for 60 years. We just celebrated our 60 years last year. Currently, we have about 1,950 employees at the plant in Roseau. We recently had a three-year capital investment program that injected $16 million into the plant. This was really to ensure that we could continue producing our vehicles from model year 14, model year 15, and then beyond. Our investment in Minnesota goes beyond that. We have 122 suppliers across the state, greater Minnesota, the seven county metro area, totaling about $6 million. We have 59 dealers across the state, small, medium, large communities. And as Todd and Representative Fabian have alluded to, we have some challenges in Roseau. And it's really around the ability to continue operations at the pace that we need to continue them, given the lack of adequate workforce, and part of that issue is a result of housing. In 2015, we need to fill 300 positions in Roseau through attrition and new need. Currently, there are 34 open operations positions, so those are assembly and things of that nature, across 29 job functions. We have six engineering positions currently open. The average starting wage for assembly positions is $14.25 an hour, and that's for first shift. It's higher for off shifts, and then we also have higher wages for skilled trades like welding and such. And the average hourly wage for non-exempt employees is $19.48, plus each employee at Polaris receives profit sharing, which is a percentage of their wage each year. In fact, it's going to be this Friday. In terms of what we've tried to do as an employer in Roseau to help alleviate some of the concerns that Representative Fabian and Todd addressed was we've increased our starting salary for assembly operators by over 12%. We have referral bonuses that we pay to employees of $1,000. We have relocation and signing bonuses. We recruit in high unemployment areas of the country, not just here in Minnesota, but we've had to extend our reach to other parts of the country. We do targeted outreach to veterans groups. And engage in a broad array of different types of advertising programs to try and encourage people to come to Roseau. The issue is not unique to Polaris. I want to point out that Polaris, our HR team in Roseau, gets together quarterly with Articat, DigiKey, Central Boiler, some of the other Marvin Windows, some of the other companies that you've heard of today, to brainstorm ideas that we all face, and I know that many of the members here have heard similar concerns from their constituent businesses. The other concern that we have is this extends to our suppliers that are across the state as well. They are also struggling to find qualified workers, giving shortages of housing and so on and so forth. And in terms of what Polaris has done, we worked with Todd and the city of Roseau on the grant program from last year. We also provided a $300,000 loan to a Tamarack Place, a 40-unit market rate housing project in the city of Roseau. We've also made some investments in temporary housing so that we actually have workers come from other facilities up to make sure the lines are continually running in Roseau. We house people there. And so I think the bill that Representative Mahoney has provided you is a good first step. It's definitely something that is needed. And you know, we would certainly support any ideas to make this a sustainable solution, not just for Roseau, but really all of Greater Minnesota.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Mahoney.
I think you got the attitude right. I think you just got the name wrong.
He's sticking people's minds. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, as you can tell in a short period of time, and we could discuss this for a long, long time. And as I said earlier, we can walk through the bill section by section. I've worked a lot with the League of Minnesota Cities and the Coalition and so forth on issues like this. You know, like I said, for me, this is a starting point. I'm happy to have the discussion with members offline individually. I appreciate Representative Dill getting an amendment. You know, it's and Mr. Burke talks about the Polaris, but this is a spillover that goes to all businesses. It doesn't affect just them. It affects our local. My wife is the director of nurses at the hospital in Roseau. You know, it affects how they can hire people there. It affects the local restaurants and the hardware stores. It affects businesses in Badger and Greenbush and all those other communities, too. So I would, and I know it's not just northwestern Minnesota, but it's very interesting to me when I take a look at the good fortune that many of those businesses have had to be able to grow and expand and add workers. In some cases, some of that expansion has come out of the side of the state of Minnesota for business reasons. And if there's something that we can do to keep workers here in Minnesota, to keep that expansion in Crookston, for example, instead of Grafton, I think that would be a great step. So, Mr. Chair, I would defer to you as to how you would like to proceed here. I would like to have Patrick come forward at some point.
I would like to ask the audience if anyone would like to testify for or against this bill. Mr. Hines, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Patrick Hines. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I want to thank Representative Fabian for once again carrying two workforce housing bills that are supported by the League, and would also like to thank Mr. Peterson again. It's one of my parts of my job are to ask people to come down and testify on these bills, and asking someone to come from Roseau repeatedly can be difficult, but he's done it, and I greatly appreciate it. The League does support this legislation. We've been working with our member cities for the past 2.5 years to try to figure out why market rate housing isn't being built in communities that have great demand for it. I think Mr. Peterson did an excellent job laying out the situation in Roseau, and we're seeing that situation repeated in cities like Perham. I know we have people from Perham to testify in another bill. The city of Windham, we also have the city administrator from Windham here to testify. So we're seeing it across the state, and what we're trying to do with this bill and with the tax increment financing bill that's also on the agenda are to provide cities with the ability to fill these financing gaps in the housing market, because right now, for reasons of low rental rates, a lack of comparables, and the resulting low appraisals, we're just not able to traditionally finance these buildings. And so our hope is that, whether through tax increment financing or grant funding from the state, we can close those financing gaps and get these housing units built, both to immediately add jobs to the community, but also to try to get the market corrected so that in the future these units can be built without state assistance. I'd be happy to answer any questions that the members have.
Questions from the member for Mr. Hines or the bill? Representative Mahoney.
I don't have a question for Mr. Hines. I have a question for Mr. Peterson.
Very well.
You alluded to the fact that this has been an ongoing problem for 19 years. You had the same problem 19 years ago, only there was a building boom. And my question is this going to be, is it going to be the same problem 19 years from now? There's something fundamentally wrong, not just in Roseau or Baudette or Thief River Falls or Crookston, but from this map, 4,500 to 7,500 households were in need of that for workforce housing. I get it. Have you had economists come in and kind of sit down and try to figure out what's going on here? Because, you know, I grew up reading all the lefty stuff in the world. And like, this bill is pretty close to it. I love it. I'm finding it great. It's like, we're going to subsidize housing for everyone here. So, but that's not what our capitalist system is. And I've grown older, and I've gotten a little bit more into the capitalism of the world. So can you tell me, if you're having this problem over and over and over again, why?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I guess I'm not an economist. I don't have all the answers to that. But one thing that was different 19 years ago was there was a lot more construction going on. We did have some apartments built at that time. We were able to address some of the housing needs that Polaris was seeing at that time when they were going through a surge of hiring. One thing that's much different today is the costs. The costs are a lot different. Some of them fundamentally changed as a result of, you know, changes in, I think one of the biggest ones is building codes. I talked with the developer who was doing our current apartment project, and he said, if I could have built this apartment the way I could have built it 20 years ago, it would be much more profitable for me. But because, you know, I have to use this circuit breaker now that costs four times as much as the one I could have used, you know, 20 years ago, there was more profit. We've taken some of that profit away without changing other things in the economy that would have driven up either wages or some other things. So I think the difference is just not a lot of the profit has been taken out of the construction cost. The costs have just gone up faster than wages have gone up. So I think that's the rub we're getting here. And as a result of not seeing construction for many, many years, most of the units that are for sale or out there are 20, 30 years old. And so they're being financed at levels that you can make money at as opposed to a new construction. We somehow need to get more new construction going so that we can start moving rents higher so things can start to catch up. I think the lack of building of apartments over the last 20 years has really created a lot of the problem, and we need to get it moving. But again, I'm not an economist, so I don't have all of the data that would support that. That's just what we've seen in our view of what's happening in Roseau, anyway.
Representative Fabian has been getting wiggly like Mahoney. I just wondered, did you have something you wanted to add?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Mahoney, I don't like to date myself necessarily, but 38 years ago when I moved to Roseau, I was the very first occupant to move into what was called at that time the Rao Rob Apartments. The Rao Rob Apartments were built by some local contractors. And I don't remember the exact number in there. There's different owners today. Former students of mine own that. And oh, by the way, the people who are developing the project that we're talking about now are two of my former students as well. But to your point about what's different from today versus 19 years ago, Mr. Peterson points out, it has to do so much with the cost of construction. When I talk to people at the Department of Labor and Industry about new building codes and so forth, when I talk to contractors, all of those things add costs. And a unit that a few years ago, 19 years ago, when you adjusted for inflation, is way more expensive today. And I understand the good intentions that have been put into some of those building codes. I get that. You know, energy efficiency and all those things. But the reality is that it inflates the costs, and wages don't necessarily keep up with it. I'm not an economist, but I see what's going on in the state of Minnesota with a lot of these things, and we've got to try and come up with some answers. I appreciate your concerns about the market and capitalism and all that stuff. I understand all of that, and I appreciate all that. That's me. But the reality is that if we don't do something, they're going to wind up in Vermilion, South Dakota, or Sioux Falls, or wherever, and we're going to ask ourselves 19 years from now, why didn't we do something, maybe? You know, I don't know. I can't gaze into that crystal ball and define all these issues with clarity, but I know I don't want to just stand still and hope that it gets better.
Well, members, just so you don't start blaming the Department of Labor and Industry, most of those codes are national codes and are driven by a national organization and the insurance companies, because they won't insure housing or apartments unless they have that $4 or $14 breaker because of fire codes or, you know, I'm trying to think of the 2x12s they use now, you know, the glued plywood rather than just a straight up 2x10. I mean, those are all national stuff that's gone in, and we just get forced to adopt that. So don't blame Dolly on that one, sir. I'm shaking my pencil.
Two more questions and two more bills.
Well,
I appreciate your answer. I just may say that statement. Representative Dill.
No. Okay.
I got one other question, Mr. Chair.
Okay, speak to me.
Why aren't the 11 counties good enough to be part of this? Why don't I get to participate? I got workforce housing problems. I've got substandard housing. And again, we in the metro get blamed for all the problems and get left out of all the solutions. So I'll be voting against your bill just on principle.
Not to speak anything. Thanks, you, Mr. Chair. I have a son that lives in Moorhead, works in Fargo. If the same building codes apply, it seems to me that's a workforce. My son hires people, dismisses those, but he tells me there's 40,000 jobs in Fargo. If you look at the market, the building, I assume some of those people that work in Fargo live in Moorhead. But you go across the river and you see buildings going up all over the place in South Fargo and West Fargo, and it's expanding according to some of those same building codes. You don't see that in Moorhead. I'm just wondering if indeed, you know, the workforce is still the same, but I think free enterprise is working much better in Fargo and in the west side of the river than it is on the east side of the river. So rather than influx more public money into the problem, I would say let's free up some of the restrictions and let private develop in Minnesota. And that's more comments than, but I see that comes from a small tire dealer that believes in the free enterprise system.
Any other questions? Seeing none, I will renew my motion to have House File 422 as amendment passed and be sent to Jobs. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay.
No.
Motion passes. Next we have House File 604. And this will be sent to Jobs. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I want to be respectful of people's times. The TIF bill that we have here, House File 684, is very similar to what we attempted last year. And for the sake of the committee, I'd like to ask Patrick Hines to do a quick run-through on the bill, if it so pleases the chair.
Welcome to our committee again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Patrick Hines with the League of Minnesota Cities. House File 684 would expand the allowable use for an economic development TIF district so that it could be used to finance workforce housing. There are a number of different types of TIF districts. The two that are particularly relevant for this bill are the economic development district and a housing district. A housing district under current law will last for 25 years, so the increment collected will be for 25 years to help develop affordable housing. There is a requirement that the units funded through an affordable housing TIF have income restrictions on them, so you cannot use them for the type of market rate workforce housing we've been talking about here. An economic development district has a duration of 9 years, and that is traditionally used for helping to finance perhaps a new factory or a new building to house an employer, a research and development facility, perhaps a warehousing storage facility. This bill would allow the economic development TIF district to be used for workforce housing. It has been done that way in the past. The city of Perham used it in 2010 when the legislature temporarily expanded the allowable use of economic development districts, and Perham was able to use that for to expand 48 units of workforce housing in its community. So we think this is another option for cities to help close that financing gap in the ROSO project. It may have generated a couple $100,000 in tax increment, which could have been used to help buy down that financing. And I'll stand for any questions if members have it.
Any questions from the members? Seeing none, any questions from the audience? Seeing none.
Yeah.
Oh, Representative Norton.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I stepped out during the middle of the last bill that Representative Fabian had. So just in general, wasn't there some funding in 2014 for ROSO and Thief River Falls as well? And so this is in addition to that, or was it for a different purpose? But I do.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Norton, what happened in 2014 was, I started out with my TIF bill, and that kind of got put in a drawer somewhere, and they came out with a grant program that was administered through the Department of Employment and Economic Development. It was a pilot project. The idea originated in the Senate. It came into the final tax bill, I believe, and conference committee, and that was the first that I had seen of that. So what they did there, this would not be the TIF thing now. I don't know that would have any impact on the existing project that's going on. And Mr. Peterson probably would have to, he's shaking his head, so that wouldn't. And what happened there is, as I told a group of people earlier today, it's not what I had intended. I felt like I'd worked in good faith with many cities throughout the state, constructing, working with House Research and the Revisor's Office to get this TIF bill constructed very narrowly, so it's used for economic development, workforce housing, and you know how things work around here sometimes. It wasn't what I had advocated for. This TIF, for me, is an attempt to allow local elected officials a tool that they want to use. Real quickly, I had an interview last year during this whole thing, a local business publication down here, and the interviewer asked me, they said, well, Dan, aren't you concerned that your locally elected officials might use this TIF authority to create luxury apartments? And I said, you ever been to ROSO? And he said, well, no, I haven't. And I said, well, you know, the only things that we construct that are luxurious are the things that we hunt deer out of when we fish walleyes in the wintertime. So this, for me, is just a common sense local control issue, and it would have no impact on what's already happened.
Okay. Mr. Chairman. So the money from last year is actually being used, just not for what you intended? I may not be understanding.
Sure. It is being used. It was done through a grant program through the Department of Employment and Economic Development. It was a pilot project that was set up specifically for ROSO County and Pennington County. And again, like I said, it originated in the Senate. Mr. Hines can probably address it a little bit.
Yeah, so could you maybe tell me what that grant is being used for that we're going to do an additional one? Are they different purposes? Is it a duplication? I assume not.
Mr. Chair and Representative Norton, the pilot program passed last year, appropriated $2 million to DEED, and there, three cities in Roseau, Pennington, and Roseau and Pennington counties were eligible to apply for grants to develop workforce housing. The city of Roseau was the first city to do so, and the Parkland Place project that Mr. Peterson was describing included $325,000 from that pilot program. The city of Thief River Falls is in the process of applying for another grant from that $2 million pool. The bill that was just passed by the committee is modeled after the pilot program, except it applies statewide so that communities meeting the criteria in any part of the state would be able to apply. So it wouldn't impact the Roseau project at all. And similarly, the TIF bill that we're discussing now would not impact that Roseau project. So I think Mr. Peterson has very graciously come a long way to tell his story, despite the fact that Roseau is not getting any special benefit from this legislation. Now, they could apply in the future if there was a statewide program, but I hope that answers your question.
I think that does. And Mr. Chair, if I could just follow up with, in this particular bill that you have before you, have you worked with DEED on to pull this together, or are they...
Mr. Chair and Representative Norton, on House File 684, that's the tax increment financing bill. That would not
this other one
implicate DEED in any way. The other bill that was already passed, DEED is administering the pilot program now, and our anticipation would be if this passed, they would continue to operate in the same way they do now.
Okay. Thank you. And I apologize for going back to 422. I just stepped out and didn't want to...
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to have a conversation with Representative Norton offline, too, just so you know.
Representative
Dill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm looking at line 3.29, that subdivision 3. And it talks about, I'm drilling down into one of the most, northern rural communities. So at least one business in the municipality or within 15 miles of the municipality that employs a minimum of 20 full-time people. So we've got the city of Orr. And there's no employers that employ 20 full-time people in the city of Orr, but 18 miles from the town of Orr is the Northwood School, which is part of a consolidation, and there are lots of teachers and staff there, and there's a tremendous demand on the city of Orr because they have the only water and sewer district in that area, water and sewer system, and so where there is housing built, it's built there. So my question is, with those two pieces in there, how do I make that work? Because the major employer is more than 15 miles. It's 18 miles closest to the nearest municipality. How do I get this TIF to apply? Just a question. I see Representative Fabian wiggling his pencil.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I would be more than happy to sit down with Representative Dill, and who knows, we might have another Dill amendment as the process moves forward.
Mr. Chairman, I know you living in a rural community like ours, there's all these little outliers out there that, you write a bill, and I've done it many times myself, and I appreciate your indulgence in looking at something like that. Thank you.
Representative Mahoney.
So, Representative Fabian, is this another bill that doesn't apply to urban areas?
Mr. Chair, no, it does not.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, what have you got against the urban Minnesota? For the love of Mike, please, tell me what you and your caucus has against the 11-county metro area. What did we do? We provide almost 75% of the general tax revenue in this state. And about 60% of it goes outside of our borders. And we are not only the bastard stepchild, I can't think of what was worse, but something. And I'm a little tired of it.
Representative Mahoney, the last bill did apply to the metro area. This one does not, so you're correct.
Again, just a comment, but after a while, if the metro area starts figuring out that you guys all hate us, and just want to drain our money out of our districts, we're going to certainly figure it out. And I'm a little tired of seeing it.
Any other questions or comments? Seeing none, I will renew my motion to have House File 684 pass and be sent to Jobs. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion passes. Thank you very much. Next, we have Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Hamilton's supposed to come up. Set the lead all amendment. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. If I could get somebody to move the bill.
I will move House File 749
all right.
To pass and be sent to GovOps.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe we have an amendment as well.
That's correct. You have the DE-8 amendment to put the bill in the shape you'd like to have it in, correctly?
And
delete all amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And when we were putting this amendment together, we did speak to a few others, if I can say Representative Norton and others. And, Mr. Chairman, would it be appropriate to ask for an oral amendment at this time? Would that be okay, Mr. Chairman?
As long as it's not overly long, fine.
All right, Mr. Chairman, what we would ask is on line 1.6, delete everything after the word city. And on line 1.7, delete 39,000, leave the period and move it up.
Okay.
Okay.
Do we understand the oral amendment? I move the oral amendment to the DE-8 amendment. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Now we have the delete all amendment, so I assume that's your new bill, 749.
Would
you describe your bill for us, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And yes, it's the time. I do have a testifier, Mr. Dorman, to walk through the bill. I also have a couple testifiers, and then I really want to address some of the questions and comments that were brought up earlier, so I'll save my comments to the end.
Very well. Mr. Dorman, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As always, I'm pleased to be before your committee. My name is Dan Dorman. I'm the Executive Director of the Greater Minnesota Partnership, and we're pleased to work with Representative Hamilton on this bill. We think it's a really good way to address the workforce housing need that we're facing in Greater Minnesota. We described it a little bit in a prior hearing to you, and the bill has changed a little bit, as Representative Hamilton noted. There used to be two different tax credits, and after consultation with the author here, the author in the Senate, and others, decided just to combine those into one. So the bill's a little bit slimmer than it was before. There's a tax credit portion, which is $30 million, and that is a 50% tax credit available to developers that would build workforce housing in Greater Minnesota. The other component to it is a $20 million grant fund that is somewhat similar to the pilot project from last year. The idea of both of these is to recognize the fact that I was interested when I saw the chart that Minnesota Housing Finance put out. It talked about job creation, but it overlooks, and maybe they could add it to it, one very important component, which is the job vacancy rate. Since 2006, when the economy started to heat back up, the job vacancy rate in Greater Minnesota is up almost 58% from that time. Until about the last 6 months, it was actually negative in the metro area, but is now up about 5%. So there's a tremendous difference in the amount of jobs that are unfilled in Greater Minnesota, and one of the drivers causing that, those jobs to go unfilled, is a lack of affordable workforce housing, which is very different than low-income housing. I think the state does, it invests quite a bit of money in low-income housing. Most of that does end up in the metropolitan area. We're not certainly speaking against that. I think that The state has to recognize there are different deeds, there are different needs in different parts of the state, and we do get that. But when you go out and talk to manufacturers, school districts, hospitals in just about any part of greater Minnesota, you hear about workforce housing being an issue. And we think that this is a very good and appropriate response to that. The third component to the bill would be to set up kind of patterned after the Office of Broadband and Office of Workforce Housing within DEED. We think it's important that, much like the transfer of the responsibility from broadband from Commerce to DEED, that this money should flow through DEED, that DEED should take a look at it, not from a, but from a job, I wouldn't even say job creation, but a job fulfillment. Where can we get people working in Minnesota and contributing to the economy? And in border communities, particularly I think of AGCO down in Jackson, they have over 30% of their workforce drives from more than 30 miles away. What they're saying is, we'd like to grow the business, but we need this community to grow in order to do that. And we think that this would be one way to address that situation. So, Mr. Chair, I know we've talked about this before the committee at least once or twice. I did want to go over the changes that we have made to the bill. Another change is that would currently limit 40% of the funds to going into one county. That may change as it weaves its way through the process, but it is a way in order to try to get this money into as many different communities as possible and not simply one or two larger regional centers or just one or two communities. So with that, Mr. Chair, I think that's an overview. I'd be happy to provide more detail if you or any of the members would like.
We have a little housekeeping we have to do, and Ms. Munn will describe what has to be done with the oral amendment and so forth.
Sure. Chair and representatives, for the DE-8 amendment to House File 749, on page 1, line 6, after the second city, delete everything after that, and on page 1, line 7, delete everything. And then the second oral amendment is a typo, and it's on page 3, line 23, and it would be to delete everything after the semicolon, and on page 3, delete line 24. And those would be the two oral amendments to the DE-8.
Okay. Does everybody understand those two oral amendments? All in favor of the two oral amendments to the DE-8 amendment or the bill, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Okay, that passes. Now, Representative Dorman asks for questions. Representative Mahoney or Barrett? Who's first?
Gil?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so I actually have a testifier I'd like to have come down, and I think that we've worked that out with the committee administrator. But we talked about, again, I'm afraid almost with Representative Mahoney talking about his issue, that I'm afraid to almost talk about my issue, because we keep going back to all of these bills that are coming through that are, for rural Minnesota, they're good bills. They don't include a lot of them, his concern. Mm-hmm. However, there are so many holes. These bills remind me of fishing with you, Chairman, and me netting your walleye, except it goes through a hole in the net, and it goes back in the lake. And that's how it's happening to housing out where it's really rural. And people keep using greater Minnesota and rural Minnesota. Well, like, we're greater, 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 or like not even almost, not Minnesota.
Canada?
Almost. And so as these bills come forward, you're probably going to hear me bringing this up routinely. And so I've talked to Representative Dorman, former Representative Dorman, about some ideas to put into his bill that would incorporate and close some of those, mend the net so the walleye doesn't get through and we actually get to eat it. So I'd like to hear from him, and then maybe my testifier, who came all the way from Grand Marais today to testify on actually the Fabian bill, but since he accepted my amendment so readily, I thought maybe we could pass on that. But I guess my question is to Representative Dorman, and to our great ag chairman, what do you intend to keep working on this so that we get those the hole in the net closed, so that we can get down to the more smaller communities that drive bigger, longer distances and all those things? All that talk to get to that question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Dill. There was a provision that I didn't I didn't understand it. There's a provision in there, and we were just having a sidebar conversation in the back and how it related to an issue that you have in the area in which you serve. And so, Mr. Chairman, at this point in time, I would like to ask those testifiers to come back as well. They were educating me, Representative Dill, on that issue back there, because I believe that was in the first version mm-hmm. of the bill. And so, Mr. Chairman, if we could please bring them down as well to testify.
Come on down.
And, Mr. Chairman, you notice that the tone of my voice is quite relaxed because I don't want to sound whiny.
And
if you could acknowledge that, you acknowledge
I will.
That.
I appreciate something. I appreciate you and Representative Mahoney.
And, Mr. Chairman.
What's that? I appreciate you.
And, Mr. Chairman, as the testifiers comes down here, what I like about this is we're bringing forth ideas. You know, there's multiple ideas. I had the opportunity to sit and listen to some of the bills beforehand. And through this process, hopefully we can work out the kinks and come forth with some solid legislation. Mr. Chairman, testifier, please.
Please give your name for the record, sir.
Hi, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Boyd. I'm the executive director of the Cook County Chamber of Commerce in Grand Marais. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks especially to Representative Fabian and Representative Hamilton, and of course to Representative Dill, with whom we're always thankful. We have a serious workforce housing shortage in Cook County, and the way the bills were originally written, they wouldn't have helped us at all, because we have one incorporated city that has fewer than 1,500 people, that's Grand Marais. The remainder of the county is unincorporated. And our most serious workforce housing challenge is actually in the West End, which is our economic engine, and around Lutzen and Tofte. Those are unincorporated areas. And so working with a number of authors on a number of bills in both the Senate and the House, we've been looking for language that includes as the qualifying area an area served by a joint city-county economic development authority created by special law, I think the language says, because we're the only one in the state. The reasons why, I've been listening to this, the reasons why we have a problem are complicated, but one of them is that the number of programs available to young people particularly have gone away. When I was a young master's degree journalist in Boise, Idaho, with the Veterans Administration program, because I was a Vietnam vet, the only way I got my first house was through the Farmers Home Administration. That program's pretty well disappeared. A lot of those opportunities for young people have disappeared. In my county, our population has been absolutely static since 2000. But when you look at the percentage of people my age, over 65, who brought, I brought a Star Tribune pension with me, I brought some unearned income from an IRA. The percentage of people in Cook County my age has gone from 12 to 22. And we brought that unearned income with us, and we bid up the price of housing. Also, when I lived in the Longfellow neighborhood of Minneapolis, and by the way, I love Minneapolis. I wrote about it for the Star Tribune editorial pages for many years. If someone put up an apartment building, they socialized a fair number of the cost. The roads, the electrical lines, the sewer. In Cook County, outside of Grand Marais, if you build an apartment building, and I think there's been one four-unit complex in the last 20 years, you pay for the roads, you pay for the sewer, you pay for the electrical lines, you pay for everything. And the infrastructure costs are huge. So we don't have any housing. It doesn't matter whether you're a teacher or a government employee or a tourism employee, there simply are no housing units available. And so why I'm here is to ask that as you consider all of these workforce housing bills, please consider making Cook County eligible for whatever you do so that we have the most tools possible in our toolbox as we try, finally, after several decades, to solve this problem.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
And while we're at it, we have testifiers from Perham. And I'd certainly like to have them come up. And we have limited time, and we have to pass this bill. And we have a testifier also at the deal. So would you please come up and let us hear the wisdom of your words also. For that guy?
I think Representative Hamilton can answer it.
Representative Norton has a question.
Thank you. On the original bill, on line 1.13, you had consolidated population center language. Would that language take care of the Cook County issue or not? And maybe it's for Representative Dill. I know that's kind of weird to ask across the table, but.
Yeah, we're going to want to have a lower number than that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and
I think this all
about the demography and the situation in the county and the city.
This bill has another couple steps to go.
Okay, I was just going to offer to reinsert that if it was appropriate language, but since it's not, let's just wait and we'll tweak it.
We need, Mr. Chairman, we need to work on that a little more with the author.
Okay.
I think both bills have a couple steps to go, and as Representative Fabian said, all housing ideas are good ideas, and he wants to hear them all. We'll try to incorporate them in one major housing bill. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can we hear from the testifiers, please?
I'd love to.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm Chuck Johnson. I'm the EDA director in the city of Perham. I want to talk a little bit about the city of Perham to see how Perham is part of this big picture that everybody's talking about today. Perham is a town of 3,000 people. Deed has done a job analysis in the city of Perham. Perham has 4,400 jobs in a city of 3,000 people. Typically, if a small town like a Perham has one major employer, they say, that's really cool, we've got one major employer. Perham has a whole bushel basket of those major employers, and that's why we've got 4,400 jobs. We've got Arvik Telecom, is one of the largest privately owned telecoms in the United States, one of the largest telecoms in the state of Minnesota. We have KLN. You may not have heard of KLN, but you probably have heard of Barrel of Fun, especially if you've been a Twins fan for the last couple of years. You may have heard of Tuffy's, if you've got a cat or a dog that you feed Nutrisource pet food. You may have heard of Kenny's Candies, especially if you've eaten some Australian licorice in the last couple of years. Nutheads is the newest member to KLN. Cucamonga Crunch is what they're making. We're home to Industrial Finishing Services. You may not have heard of that, but if you drive a John Deere lawn tractor, you probably have parts that have been painted at Industrial Finishing Services in Perham. We're home to Kitmasters. You probably haven't heard of Kitmasters. If you were an over-the-road trucker, you'd have a bunch of parts under your hood that were either manufactured or remanufactured at Fine Guards Creameries. Those companies that I just mentioned export to 21 countries around the world. Estonia, Latvia, Australia, New Zealand, you name it. They're all over the world. Of course, hand-in-hand with that and the fact that there's jobs, a lot of housing has occurred, and we're struggling with that today. One of the things that's happened with Perham housing is that we're a little bit upside down with the amount of rental housing we have in Perham. 44% of our housing units are rental. That's way above the state average. 25% is the state average. It's come about that way because it's the solution that's come about, the best solution possible to help provide housing for all those workers that I talked about. We did a housing survey in 2014. That housing survey showed that of our apartment units, we had 278 of those apartment units in Perham. There was one vacancy out of 278 units last year. The census showed that we have, there's other types of rentals that are available in Perham. We've got 468 of those. At that point, when the census was conducted, there was 18 vacancies. Things have been exploding in Perham. The industries have been growing. In the last 2 years, the city of Perham has issued $56 million in building permits. That's just brick and mortar. If we took that and step back a little, couple more years in time, and take a look at total capital outlay, including equipment, that type of capital outlay, those companies that I've mentioned have invested $159 million in the last several or more years, and they've added almost 600,000 square feet of production surface.
Perm, housing has been going up in Perm. We're struggling with it today. In the last 7 years or so, we've added 145 rental units in Perm, and we've added about 50 assisted living units. But the struggle we have today, as has been discussed previously, is the fact that in today's marketplace, developers can't make those new units cash flow, especially with the rents that they can charge. And you can say, well, why don't the industries raise their wages so that those people can make more money and they can pay more rent? But remember I said Perm is part of the exporting economy. We're in 21 countries, and I think Perm products are in all 48 states around the United States. Perm, those industries are competing with those people on a national level, on an international level, and they're subject to the competition that comes with that.
Mr. Johnson, we're past our time.
Okay.
And we got your message.
Okay, thank you.
And we have Mr. Nasby would like to say a few words also.
You want to say a few words?
Or Mr. Saylor. You can make your statements very short and concise. I'd appreciate it.
How about if I just drop off some gifts, sir?
That would be terrific.
If I could sweeten up the committee a little bit with some KLN product. Please beware, though, there is one bag of dog food in here.
Okay. I fed my dog Tuffies for years. Yes.
Mr. Chair, can we save that bag of dog food for Representative Mahoney?
Ooh, where is he at? No, that's cheese he needs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, I will be brief. I just wanted to say, as a representative, my name is Fred Saylor. I'm a recruiter with KLN Family Brands, and I just wanted to say to you that we have done about everything we possibly can to bring people in to fill jobs. Our company itself is still 100 short of filling all of our jobs. The community of Perm is 250 people short of filling those jobs. So we've done everything we can at KLN, from free health care to profit sharing, which translates into an entry-level unskilled job will begin, if you take it all into account, will begin between $21 and $23 an hour. We feel that's very competitive for an unskilled position. We're also standing, have visited every armory and every tech school from Moorhead to Minneapolis to look for veterans and young, talented, skilled people to come and help us grow our companies. With that, I don't want to take any more time other than to say that we employ 1,200 Minnesotans, and we are growing. We have expanded to Erie, Pennsylvania, where we opened up 25 jobs and had 800 people apply for those jobs. It has now grown into 125 jobs within 6 months. We also have opened a plant in Phoenix, Arizona, with the same thing, to find agricultural resources as well as human resources. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Nasby, or whoever, thank you very much for your testimony. And you have a problem that many places wish they had. Mm-hmm. Please give your testimony. Your name, please.
Thank you, Representative Gunther. My name is Steve Nasby. I'm the city administrator in Windham, Minnesota. Windham's in the southwest part of the state. We've got, our population is 4,646. We've got a similar problem to the other folks you've heard about today. We've got Toro Facility, who's a major employer in our area, Fast Manufacturing Distributing, PM Windham is a beef packing plant, big game, and we were recently designated a primary site for a data center. Where we're running into our problems, as everyone else, is lack of housing. We just don't have the ability to have it built for some of the same market reasons that the gentleman from Roseau and others have spoken with you about. So what it really does is it's impeding our growth. We've been stuck about the same population for the last couple of decades. Looking forward, you know, I don't see it getting a whole lot better. The city invested in housing about 15 years ago through our EDA and built some. We're certainly maintaining that, and that's full, and we've got a waiting list. We are working with partners to try to push those things forward. But I think one of the things that we need to, that maybe hasn't been said, is we also have a risk. And it's not that we can't grow, it's that the companies that we have could leave. If Toro can't find enough folks or some of these other people, maybe it's not expansion anymore. Maybe it's I pick up and I go. And that would be devastating to many of our local economies. thank you very much for your time. I certainly appreciate it and all of your work.
Anybody else you have, Brian?
Mr. Chairman, just thank you, and committee members, Representative Norton, we'll keep working with you on this as well. Representative Dill, we'll work with you, and if you can put in a good word with your senator, we have some other legislation we'll need his support on as well, and we'll continue working with you. Mr. Chairman, I was hoping, I wanted to field some of the earlier questions, but I know we ran out of time, so I'll just leave it at that.
I appreciate it. And with that, I will renew my motion to have House File 749 be passed as amended. All in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion passed. Thank you very much. Very good testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank
you.
And we are adjourned. Thank you very much.